think or depression may occur. Stay in your home. Curfew is at 7 p.m. sharp after work. Anyone caught outside the gates of their subdivision sectors after curfew will be shot. Remain calm. Do not panic. Your neighborhood watch officer will be by to collect urine samples in the morning. Anyone caught interfering with the collection of urine samples will be shot. National security is more important than individual will. All sports broadcasts will proceed as normal. No more than two people may gather anywhere without permission. Use only the drugs prescribed by your boss or supervisor. Shut up! Be happy! Obey all orders without question! The comfort you demanded is now mandatory. Be happy. At last, everything is done for you.
White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, here in the bunker right here in north central Indiana on an overcast day, and it's cool, and but no rain and no snow. So that's it. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Our big newly renovated website is resist.com. And that's where you go for a Harvard education, man, on the race issue and on economics and all kinds of things, environmental stuff, and where you can find out what rotten shit the government's playing on us now. Yeah. Well, let's check in on a couple of these Republican candidates. Yeah, right. On Monday night, Republican Senator Ted Cruz upset Donald Trump in the Iowa caucus. Of course, these weren't direct votes. These were caucuses, taking the first state of the primary campaign. But it was Florida Senator Marco Rubio who most outperformed his projections, placing third. Just 1 point behind Trump and beating his Iowa polling average by 6 points, more than any other candidate. Rubio had campaigned vigorously in Iowa in the final days before the caucuses as a devout Jesus-loving Christian. Likewise, contributing to his late surge, he even took a moment to honor a Jewish yarmulke salesman and wish voters had got Shabbos. According to Mark Daniels, an enterprising entrepreneur who had decamped to Iowa to sell skull caps featuring the candidates' names, Rubio gamely attempted to record a Sabbath greeting at Daniels' urging. Though Rubio was probably familiar with such salutations from his time in Jew Florida, one of his biggest backers is the Jewish automotive magnate Norman Brahman. He was a little thrown by the Yiddish in gut, and it took him a couple of tries. Interesting. Gut chabos or boot chabos, you decide. Whatever that is. So, one of his biggest backers is the Florida Jewish automotive magnate. How about that? I would be surprised if it wasn't.
Well, there you go. I had my microphone turned around again. It's got a little red light in it, but sometimes I don't see it. I guess tonight they're having another debate up there in the Northeast. How about that? We'll see what happens. Well, here's my sort of funny for the day. I'm glad sunscreen has been shown to be associated with more skin cancer than less. It's not in the mainstream media yet, but the biggest jump in skin cancer has occurred since the advent of sunscreen. That kind of thing makes me happy. The fact that people in pursuit of a superficial look of health give themselves a fatal disease. I love it when reasoning human beings think they have figured out how to beat something and it comes right back to kick them in the ass. God bless the law of unintended consequences. And the irony is impressive. Healthy people trying to look healthier make themselves sick? Good. Well, let's visit our pessimist guide to history a little bit. Yeah, 1671. Buccaneers Sir Henry Morgan sacks Panama. Buccaneers, bands of adventurers and skinhead types who roamed on the high seas during the 17th century, laid claim to many destructive exploits. But for sheer audacity, none can compare with the pillaging and burning of Panama, then one of Spain's chief cities in the New World. The Welsh buccaneer Sir Henry Morgan launched the ambitious venture in 1670 with 36 ships and some 2,000 men. His chief aim, of course, was the hoard of gold and silver he expected to plunder from the opulent Spanish city. Morgan's army of buccaneers and skinheads first captured Fort St. Laurent, then set off for the city by marching overland across the Isthmus of Panama. The Spaniards withdrew before the oncoming buccaneers, burning their houses and taking with them everything edible. For 10 days, Morgan's men lived on a diet of leaves and grass, plus meat and a few horses and cows that they managed to steal. On January 27th, the starving and exhausted buccaneers and skinheads finally reached the city of Panama. There, the larger Spanish army with 2,400 foot soldiers and 400 horsemen attacked Morgan's position after driving 2,400 wild bulls ahead of them. The buccaneers were saved from being overrun and trampled by the swampy marsh, which slowed the bulls and the Spanish cavalry enough to allow the buccaneers' sharpshooters to cut the Spanish down. 600 Spaniards died before they withdrew, leaving an unknown number of wounded, who were hacked to death or shot by the buccaneers. Morgan then led his men into the city, bent on gaining its riches. However, most of Panama's residents had by now fled to a nearby island, taking most of the valuables with him. Thus, for all his efforts, Morgan gained little of the gold and silver he had sought. Instead, he found only more mundane items, a fortune in iron, flour, wine, and spices stored in the city's warehouse and shops. Wanting none of these, the enraged Morgan ordered the city burned. Over the next few weeks, Morgan's men looted the city and burned Panama to the ground. It is said that Morgan deserted his army of buccaneers soon after leaving Panama, taking most of the valuable booty with him. The escapades of Henry Morgan and his ilk made excellent scenarios for Hollywood swashbuckling movies. And I see here a mark that I've read this to you before. What the hell's the matter with me? I went to the wrong spot. Sorry. Well, I believe I found my right place here again, so we'll start off again. If I've read this to you before, just pretend it didn't happen. 1796, the White Lotus Rebellion. Faced with official persecution by the Qing Dynasty, the White Lotus Society, an illegal religious sect with followers throughout China, began an open revolt in February. As the revolt spread through central China, rebels were joined by various desperate groups, including bandits practicing martial arts, smugglers, mercenaries, and peasants who were forced into fighting, seeking to extinguish the rebellion and eliminate the rebel leaders. Government troops laid waste to villages and fields, torturing and killing citizens indiscriminately. The revolt continued for almost 10 years, with rebels waging guerrilla warfare from mountain strongholds. The government countered by creating local fortresses big enough to house the peasants and store the grain, thus cutting off supplies and additional recruits from the rebels. Government armies were also reinforced by local militias, and by 1805 some 100,000 rebels had been annihilated. Though it ultimately failed, the White Lotus Rebellion marked an important step in the decline of the Qing Dynasty. There went Qing. Yeah. There you go. There's another one. Boy, I'll tell you, people go crazy and kill everybody. I think the best thing to do is just get out of town when these things start. If I'd been living around the Civil War time and the war broke out, I'd have got on my horse and rode west as far as I could go and then hide in a cave. You're right. Okay, here's one more. In 1797, Ecuador had an earthquake. On February 4th, a tremendous earthquake collapsed the buildings, released avalanches, and started volcanoes erupting in a disaster that devastated five provinces. The city of Quito, Ecuador, was demolished, while whole mountains and rivers were also moved into the affected area. Citizens of the village of Curo may have had time to look up and see the mountainside rolling down upon them before the entire village was buried without a trace. Even as a mountain tumbled down upon the village of Mazdro, the ground split open and the houses, churches, and streets disappeared into the fissure. Only two people there survived. Meanwhile, a flood of lava erupted from the volcano Yagugla, sweeping away more than five villages in its searing path. The area was later described as a lake of smoldering lava. Talk about a hot bath. Estimates of the dead were put at 40,000 or more. Wow, that's enough of the reading of that, all that bad news, man, I'll tell you. Mother Nature gets pissed off. She lets us have it, I'll tell you. And she don't seem to like the third world too much either, you know? Well, here's an interesting quote out of the Iowa thing that ended last night. Quote, this is from the Jewish Federation of Iowa. Iowa voters in general are highly intelligent voters. I would say the Iowa Jewish voter is even more participatory in the process, unquote, he told the Post. There are only about 140,000 people participating in the caucuses, and so the way the caucus system is set up, 15 or 25 Jews in a caucus can sway the delegate camp, unquote. The Des Moines area's Jewish community is only made up of about 3,000 people, in a general population of some 500,000 residents. We are small but mighty, Edelman noted. Some immigrated after the Holocaust, some in the early 1900s and in the 1980s. A large number of Russian Jews also came to Des Moines after the fall of the Soviet Union. That reminds me, it was a bunch of Jews up there running a slaughterhouse up there that they I think they did go to jail, that they were charged by the Attorney General of Iowa for hiring wetbacks and doing illegal things. I remember that. Boy, they pushed that under the rug real fast. Most Jews in the past here in Des Moines were entrepreneurs, he said. They were small business owners and inventors, unquote. In the 80s, there was a large influx of Jewish professionals, attorneys, physicians, executives, and so on. And that's how they take over a community. That's how they do it. In the 1990s and early 2000, those Jews who owned small businesses sold or retired, and their kids left to the coast. Uh-huh. Let's see here. What else we got here? However, he said, Jewish life is thriving in the city today as more first-generation Iowans choose to live in the Hawkeye State to enjoy a better quality of life. Now it's choice to be here, and not just adults whose parents are here, but a cross-section of people all over the country, he explained. So between the Christ Insanity people in Iowa and the Jews that have floated in there, it's no wonder things get screwed up. Well, I'm shocked. It will be hard to find Jews on the basketball court in the National Basketball Association playoffs. But toss a basketball into an NBA owners meeting and you'll probably hit one. There are only 3 Jewish players in the NBA and no Jewish head coaches. Yet nearly half the principal owners of the NBA teams are Jewish, as are the league's current commissioner and its immediate past commissioner. No other major pro league in the United States has such a high proportion of Jewish owners. The NFL comes closest. Roughly a third of the league's owners are Jewish. Just a handful of pro basketball and hockey owners are Jews. So why do Jews own so many NBA teams? The answer has to do with the prehistory of pro basketball, the sport's urban roots, and the economic and modern NBA. Also, Jews are huge basketball fans. Quote, Jews love basketball, said Nathaniel Friedman, who writes widely about basketball under the pen name Bethlehem Scholes. Quote, if you ask a Jewish multimillionaire what they want, they'll probably say they want to buy the Knicks in their dreams, unquote. That reminds me of that joke I played on there by the black guy. I played it on the show where he said, when they said white men can't jump. Well, they don't have to jump. They own the team. American Jews overwhelmingly dominate the business side of pro ball, slipped awkwardly into the spotlight on April 29th when NBA Commissioner Adam Silver announced harsh sanctions against Donald Sterling, owner of the Los Angeles Clippers, at a press conference in New York. Silver levied fines and a lifetime ban against Sterling, who had been caught on tape expressing his racist attitude toward nigger people. During the question and answer session, a sports writer named Howard Megdal, who once wrote a book called The Basketball Talmud, asked whether the fact that both Silver and Sterling were Jewish had affected Silver's response to Silver's or Sterling's racist tirade. Well, I think my response was as a human being, Silver said. The interaction highlighted not only the predominance of Jewish ownership of the NBA, but also the near lack of Negro American owners. Oh, they wouldn't do that. Michael Jordan famously owns the Charlotte Bobcats. People have difficulty talking about the conflicts, tensions, and differential privileges, said David Leonard, an associate professor at Washington State University. Pullman and the author of the 2012 book, quote, After Our Test, the NBA and the Assault on Blackness. I think the moment like this become a moment of anxiety for many in the Jewish community. The 14 Jewish principal owners of the NBA teams are a diverse group. Some have been in the league for decades, others just a few years. Herbert Simon has co-owned the Indiana Pacers since 1983, right here in my own damn state. Of course, I don't give a shit about basketball myself, so it doesn't bother me. Joe Lacob and his partners bought the Golden State Warriors in 2010. Perennially strong teams like Mickey Anderson or Arison's Miami Heat are owned by Jews, as are the longtime losers like Milwaukee Bucks, which Jewish owner Herbert Cole is preparing to sell to a group co-led by Jewish hedge fund billionaire Mark Lasry. Hedge fund. Another one of those bastards. Also, Jews formed the NBA commissioner. Also, Jews former NBA commissioner David Stern, current commissioner Silver, legendary basketball broadcaster Marv Albert, and Arne Tellern, the league's leading agent, who represents 44 NBA players with a combined salary of $301 million. Back at the beginning of the professional game, the league also had prominent Jewish players and coaches. Four of the five starters of the New York Knicks were Jewish in 1946. The first season of both the team and the NBA. For such of the first half of the 20th century, Jews were very involved in basketball as players. Of course, they already took over boxing at that time. Leonard said, especially among second-generation Jewish immigrants, this became a means of asserting one's American identity, one's physical prowess. Professional baseball at the time could be an unwelcoming place for American Jews, particularly in the Jews in the years following Hank Greenberg, who went pro in 1930. Baseball owners represented an older elite, members of a native-born class of Protestant industrialists that was anxious about accepting Jews into its ranks. In other words, this were the ruling class, non-Jews. They didn't know whether they wanted to be in there or not. Basketball, however, was something else, a city game played in the urban neighborhoods where the Jews lived. The sport was familiar. It was also relatively new, virgin territory, yet to be claimed by an ethnic group like the Jews. When the sport began to professionalize, the Jews were there. It was a short step to walk into the positions of ownership, said David George. Of course, they made their money out of all kinds of gambling and prostitution and rackets. Okay, said David George Sturdum, an associate professor of economics at the University of Northern Iowa. How about that? And the author of the 2012 book, The Rise of the National Basketball Association. Eddie Gottlieb, better known as the Mogul, was the coach of the Philadelphia Warriors when the team won the Basketball Association of America's inaugural championship in 1946. A Negro League baseball promoter, Gottlieb got his start in basketball promoting the South Philadelphia Hebrew Association's team. He charged a few cents to see the game, attend the dance afterwards, and enter a raffle for a suit. When the BAA transformed into the NBA a few years later, Gottlieb remained a central figure drawing up the NBA schedule every season until his death in 1979. Interesting stuff, all you white sucker sports fans. They made billions off you people. Other Jews joined Gottlieb on the sports business side in the early days. Morris Podoloff, an attorney, was president of the BAA and then first president of the NBA. Abe Saperstein was a commissioner of the American Basketball League, the NBA's short-lived competitor, and the owner of the Harlem Globetrotters. Basketball was a Jewish sport for players, and obviously that morphed into ownership, said Jeffrey Gurok, a professor of history at Yeshiva University. It was a high-risk, entrepreneurial-type endeavor that Jews went into. Of course, this is all ancient history for today's basketball owners. Unlike the NFL, where a number of the teams have been owned by the same family since the league was founded, NBA teams tend to turn over quickly, and none has family ties to the earliest days of the sport. Sterling, who will likely be forced to sell the Clippers as a result of Silver's sanctions against him, in the league's longest tenured owner. He owned his team since 1981. These things, they like this, the idle rich like this stuff. The younger Jewish owners like Mark Cuban of the Dallas Mavericks are often basketball superfans who made their money in business and turned to basketball for fun and profit. So why are there so many of them? A lot of different kinds of people like basketball, but the Jewish love and the history of the game seems to have mixed with Jewish affluence and the availability of the NBA teams in a way that's been particularly conducive to Jewish team ownership. My armchair socializing would have it that Jews may or may not have a sense of their history in basketball, but they do love the sport, unquote, said Mark Tracy, who is a staff writer for the New Republic and the 2012 co-edited book Jewish Jocks, and when they look at the court, they don't see too many Jews, unquote. In Tracy's theory, the fandom has found expression in team ownership. That's easy to believe after watching Cuban charge the court to hug Mavericks star Vince Carter after the Carter's game-winning three-point shot against the San Antonio Spurs on April 26. Cuban celebrated harder than any of his players. Mark Cuban is the biggest Dallas Mavericks fan. Beyond being fun, owning an NBA team has turned out to be a pretty good investment. In the 1980s, basketball teams could be bought for a few million bucks. That changed dramatically in recent years. Jewish owners like Sterling and Simon, who snatched up the teams decades ago, have made out extraordinarily well. Cole, who bought the Bucks for $19 million in 1985, that's here in Indiana, is selling to Lazary and his partners at a reported $550 million. NBA teams have been an extremely good investment, Friedman said. The idea of owning a basketball team is bringing together these two Jewish cultural traditions of basketball and being good at business and screwing your fellow Christian. Yeah. Okay, there you go. That's the bottom line on Jew basketball. Since I was in the TV servicing business most of my life, plus satellite installation and so forth, and also helping to build ICBMs to wipe out the Ruskies for Douglas Aircraft, this is an interesting little thing I'll play for you.
So you've got a broken TV. That happened to my colleague's old Samsung recently, and we had two options. One, pay for an expensive authorized repair, or two, for not that much more money, buy a new one. That means sending this old TV to an e-cycler, or worse, the dump. But there's a third option the electronics industry doesn't really want us to know about. When I searched the web for repair advice for this particular Samsung, I found I could do it myself with $20 worth of parts and tools. Not every tech problem is this easily fixed. Still, we deserve the right to try. Some manufacturers stop us by limiting access to repair plans or parts. Others even employ digital software locks to keep us from making changes or repairs. It may not always be planned obsolescence, but it's certainly intentional obfuscation. In the case of this TV, Samsung doesn't make its repair manuals public, reserving them for authorized shops only. But the fix turned out to be an easy four-step process that required just generic parts and next to zero knowledge of electrical engineering or computer science. First, I opened up the TV, pulled out the power supply board, safely removed six busted capacitors. No, not flux capacitors, just these little guys. I enlisted an experienced tinkerer to help me do the soldering, but I promise it isn't much harder.
I'm not going to play the whole thing, but my advice to you is, don't try it. The miniaturization of the new TV sets is such that it's very difficult. He's correct about usually it's capacitors, and you could change them. But I got out of that business a long time ago, at least a decade ago, and I'm not going back into that. I got a note in here from one of our Russian friends. At least I believe he's a Russian friend. He found an interesting book that I might be interested in. It's Strasser's full program on National Socialism, The Structure of German Socialism. It begins on page 119. I'm reading a shortened Russian version of it and beginning to fully understand what you meant by Hitler was a national capitalist. There's a few very good points there. You might want to read the book or for a few pieces from it on the show and comment on them. I find the material worthwhile, and I think your listeners will benefit from it too. Well, it sounds like it, and I'll pick it up, and I'll do it. Anything to move people away from Hitler worship, because it was not National Socialism. It was National Capitalism. Well, with all this hubbub about democracy and the Constitution and all that stuff, I think we better go back to the good book. Yeah, Might is Right. Might is Right, Chapter 3. Just as a spider weaves his silky web to lure flies into the larder of his banqueting hall in order that he may at his leisure pick the flesh off their bones, so deceitful ideals are cunningly woven by dexterous political spiders to capture and exploit swarms of human flies. What are the grandiose paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence but the weft and the woof of a dazing spider web? And what are the American people but the flies that have been cleverly entangled in its gossamer meshes? For over a century, the Declaration has been the parchment divinity of all public orators, from the curbstone dervish to the street corner to our elective monarch in the White House. Every 4th of July, Americans habitually scream themselves hoarse over its sounding generalities, making the welkin ring with the tin horns and giant firecrackers. Flag idolatry, brass bands, toy pistols, and herd bellowing generally. Although the great majority of them are mental and physical dwindlings, poverty-stricken and propertyless, yet how insanely they delight in amusing a sardonic world with this loquacious, flamboyant charlatanry. We are sovereigns and equals is their everlasting Barmecide chorus. Sovereigns and equals. In all lunatic asylums, there may be found inmates who fancy themselves kings and queens and lords of the earth. These sorrowful creatures, if only permitted to wear imaginary crowns and issue imaginary commands, are the most docile and harmless of all maniacs. As for the American people of today, it's not their written constitution, but a cunningly constructed straitjacket. Their moral code, padded prison cells, their statute laws, handcuffs and leg irons, their captains of industry, keepers and turnkeys in clever disguise. 100 years ago, they ostensibly commenced an independent operation with the richest continent on earth as their private property, their subscribed capital, and during the whole of that period, have they not been as busy as so many relays of drought beasts of burden, pumping the tremendous natural wealth of all their home soil and pouring it overseas into the cesspools of Europe and now the Middle East, and we've done it to Asia? Is not that work the work of lunatics? They smashed and splintered the wood political yoke of an English king and then proceeded to rivet it around their necks, a brand new yoke of bolted steel, which they forged especially to fit themselves and which they dignified under the name of constitutional freedom. Is not that also the work of lunatics? Cursed indeed are the harnessed ones. Cursed are they, even though their harness be homemade, even although it tinkle with music and silver bells, eh? even though every buckle and link and rivet thereof made of solid gold. How absurd of men to hurrah over their glorious political liberty, who have not even been able to retain possession of the substantial products of their own labors. After a century of constitutional progress, 10% of the population are absolute owners of 92% of all the property. Now, O reader, are not these things the outward and visible signs of organic dementia? The Declaration of Independence commences by proclaiming the unctuous falsehood, a black, degrading, self-evident lie, a lie which no one could possibly believe but a born fool. With insolent effrontery, it brazenly proclaims as self-evident truth that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, rights which it thereupon proceeds to define in canting phraseology, imbecile and fluoride, it is false. Indeed, the mock heroic preamble of this rhetorical pronuncio is but a cunningly constructed piece of blog, desperately, deliberately intended to deceive and betray. It consists of a patchwork of plagiarized catchwords, annexed wholesale from the ravings of the 17th century levelers, crazed puritanic matoids, and 18th century cretinous French Jacobins, all mixed up and jumbled up together in a long rigmarole of semi-meaningless pretty phrases culled mostly from old-time melodrama. The Declaration of Independence has less real meaning for present conditions than a bottled-up Indian war whoop of the same period would have had, if uncorked now. It is a back number, musty, high-smelling, and worm-eaten, only fit for the walls of a museum or the brain cells of a draft philosopher. Its ethical and most of its political conclusions are shams, deceptions, and cold-blooded dishonesties, incandescent lies, glorified, belated, printed in letters of gold, but nevertheless lies. Indeed, it has always been considered a piece of amusing mockery by those who really understand the secret intent for which it was originally constructed, viz., as a lasso for the bellowing herds that about 100 years ago were beginning to run wild and escape from their herdsmen and the herdsmen's stock whip in this then boundless new world. To all the contemporary demagogues and high-sounding phraseology of the Declaration is as honey from the paradise. Everywhere its seductive abstractions are the avatars of anarchism and communism, republicanism, and scores of other zymotic convolutions. Why, then, should sane men continue giving lip service to this subtle deception? Why should they, by their silence, acquiesce to the malefic efforts of organic weaklings instigated by prattles of false philosophy, to enforce by electioneering mass pressure an impossible and hideous equality ideal? Every national appeal is now made not to the noblest and the best, but to the riffraff, the slave hordes, who possess less intelligence than the night owls. All that is brave, honorable, heroic, is ignored tacitly, for fear of offending the deified herd, the majority, equality of conditions, as its debasing Shabbalah. And verily, he who has temerity enough to spit upon equality is liable to be horned to death. The voice of the people can only be compared to the fearsome shrieks of agony that may now and then be heard issuing forth from the barred windows of a roadside madhouse. The voice of God, alas, alas. There are two methods whereby masterful ambitious men may hold any population in a state of ordered subjectivity. The first, and by far the most honorable method, is through an irresistible, highly trained standing army, ready to deploy anywhere, with mechanical precision at a telegraphic nod in order to lay down the law at the cannon's mouth and sweep away all dangerous opposition. The second and cheaper method is, first of all, to inoculate those intended to be exploited with some poisonous political soporific, superstition, or theoria, something that, operating insidiously, hypermically, may render them laborious, meek, and tractable. The latter plan has ever proved itself most effective, because Aryan populations that would fight to the last gasp against undisguised military despotism may be induced to passively submit to any indignity or extortion if their brains are first carefully soaked in some abstract lie like equality. At the period of the War of Independence, North America was far too wide, far too sparsely settled, and far too poor in concentrated wealth to be effectively ruled and plundered upon the standing army principle, either by King George or successful junta or power-wielding revolutionists. Hamilton, Hancock, Jefferson, Adams, Madison, Henry, and all the vested material interests that stood a solid phalanx behind these volatile patriots cast about for some safer method to rule the minds of the uninformed but extremely valorous yeomanry, backwoodsmen, and mountaineers. After mature consideration, they determined to lull and lure the armed peasantry back again into the condition of blissful somnolence by instilling into their newly aroused minds false and but seductive political idealisms as subtle supplements to the fallacious and the equally delusive but pre-existent religionisms and moralisms. This cunning plot worked like a charm, for equity and rights seemed to puritanic minds as the logical outcome of that other hoary old lie, equality before God. What a set of damned rascals they were. Was Governor Morris' terse, rugged, but ever memorable description of the Congress of smart corruptionists that adopted and formally proclaimed those famous and fatal abstractions? Thereupon, the sword of power that conquered on the battlefield was carefully hidden away out of sight, and constitutionalism invoked to aid in the reharnessing of the conquerors of Cornwallis by their new masters, the old system of jurisprudence and government founded on naked force, were cleverly retained, even amplified, and at the same time the white-skinned populations were cunningly proclaimed free and equal, never having enjoyed the genuine personal freedom except on the Indian border, being for the most part descendants of hunted-out European starvelings and fanatics, defeated battlers. They now stupidly thought that they had won the freedom at last by the patent device of selecting a complete outfit of new tax gatherers every year, every 4 years, like we're doing right now. When we look back upon the childlike faith in constitutionalism displayed by our revolutionary fathers, together with their infantile republican specifics for the redemption of mankind, we cannot help smiling. At every general election since 1776, Americans have voted solidly for increasing the despotic authority of their elected rulers and taskmasters. Personal liberty is very nearly unknown, except in the newspaper, and any citizen who dares to think in the direction of opposition to the dogma of majority does so at the risk of his life if he thinks too loudly. Indeed, men of initiative and enterprise are now in the regular habit of purchasing immunity from the communal molestation by bribing legislatures and officials upon the wholesale scale. The state is blackmail agency. Enterprises necessitating state permits and large preliminary expenditures of capital cannot be safely undertaken until elective satraps, aldermen, judges, governors, congressmen, presidents, senators, and so on have first negotiated a percentage rake-off. Neither life nor property is safe from the malignancy, revenge, or greed of the government officials or their confederates. He who would assert himself in this republic under present conditions must be a man of unscrupulous acumen and shrewdness. He must know the exact price of every patriot with whom business brings him in contact, and be ready to pay it without demur. With an appearance of a hearty enthusiasm. Otherwise, it will go hard with him. Should he be a poor man, his chances in life are infinitesimal, so long as he is conscientious. No citizen can call his soul his own who dares to openly attack the administrative scoundrelism based securely upon purchasable majority votes. Those thievish official peculators of Turkey, China, Persia, and Morocco would hang their heads in utter shame at their own clumsy methods of robbery if they once beheld the magnificent mechanism and finesse whereupon American politicians enrich themselves by bleeding the treasuries, stealing public lands, and sweating the revenues. Indeed, grand viziers, heaven bless them, not only plunder living generations, but they even make futurity contribute to their hungry rapacity. Their scheme of financial legerdemain are of the unparalleled brilliance and grandeur. They borrow thousands of millions upon national credits from the usurers, and then proceed to apportion the money unto each other under the elaborate pretense of needful public expenditures, redeeming the conservancy, and so forth. In order that the Jew may be secured in his usurious shint bent, oppressive taxes are laid on the peasantry, wherewith to pay the annual interest charge upon the bonded millions. All of these attributes are collectible in appreciating gold at the point of the Supreme Court's bayonet. However, military assistance is very seldom needed to enforce the tax collector's demand because most Americans are exceptionally docile and good. No need to coerce with a palsied people, ever eager to obey the slightest nod of their masters. America, America, never shall you realize the true meaning of thoroughly going independent and self-proprietorship unless or until an American Cromwell or an American Caesar has signed the death warrant of an American king. The executive who sells his people into bondage is a public enemy, whether he is an elected monarch or a hereditary king. Such a scoundrel and traitor has no rights that property-holding freemen are bound to respect. No, not one. By accepting the gold of the public plunderers, he makes himself an Ishmaelite. His hand is against every man's hearth and every man's property. Therefore, every man's hand should be uplifted against him. In days not long gone by, men of our race have hung bribe-takers with scanty ceremony, and even rolled the heads of kings into the executioner's basket. If we are not to be robbed now of everything we possess and reduced to conditions of absolute state servitude, we must not shrink from doing so again. Despotism, if it is to be overthrown, must be fought with its own weapons, and the vilest despotism are ever found upon majority votes. As for the common people, they are energetically chasing shadow paternalisms and allowing their substance to be appropriated on a giant scale. They're living in a fool's paradise of progress and peaceful industrial evolution, as the Kant phrases go. Some of these days they may possibly wake up when it's too late and discover with alarm and astonishment that all of their mock imbiecs have been of no avail against the insidious growth of centralized oligarchic hibariums, ballot box desolation, and industrial imperialism. Americans have yet to learn that each generation must fight out its own fight and not rely on the preservation of its hardihood and independence upon moth-eaten parchments or on fraudulent statesmen now in the graveyard, statesmen who spent their petty babblesome life not in doing heroic things but in founding and enthroning the abominations that afflict us all today, like palsy. Our national hero worship badly wants construction. Well, I'll tell you one thing. There needs to be revolution over and over again. Many years after the Declaration was issued, our written Constitution was constructed with much voluble sophistry and mimic strife. That document, considered as a whole, is the most cunningly worded and at the same time the most terrible instrument of government and mastership that any Anglo-Teutonic tribe has ever yoked itself up to. Pretending to grant liberty and self-government, it practically annihilates both. Under the show of guaranteeing personal independence and civil rights, it has organized an effective tyranny wherein the mob monarch possesses more arbitrary authority than any dynastic despot since the days of Darius or Belshazzar. The highest crime is actually written in the highest law of the land. Quote, thus did the great guile masters their toils and their tangles set, and as wide as was the water, so wide was woven the net. Indeed, the written Constitution of our Republic is a monstrous mechanical contrivance that bids fair, when once it's got its properly underway, to squeeze the very heart out of all the best elements in America. Our federal government may be very appropriately compared to a pirate ship cleverly disguised as a friendly armed cruiser convoying a fleet of peaceful merchantmen loaded with an immense treasure of 70 million passengers. When it first came to their assistance, it was, oh, so kindly, so affectionate, so full of loving regard for its intended prey, for the welfare and the bon voyage of its quarry. Now, however, that its 45 ships of state, and now, of course, it's 50. Where is it, 52? I forget. Now, however, the 45 ships of state are out in the open ocean and absolutely at its mercy. It strips off its decoy rig, hoists the death's head and bloody bones, opens its hidden portholes, runs out its round-lipped broadsides, and yells through its editorial speaking trumpets, quote, heave to there or you'll be blown out of the water, unquote. Thus it will be seen the Jesuitic evangel of equality has proved itself a tremendous success. It seduced the American people into the feeling of contentment and security till their bonds and fetters were properly forged, polished, and neatly riveted on. Well-fashioned indeed was the net, a splendid spider web. It has proved itself the withal needful. Under the hypnotic spell of a free and equal dream, Americans have been hustled into a convict prison of laborious to practical masters, a thousand times more terrible and more unwielding than any history can describe. All that is now left of liberty is its name, and the harmless privilege the people have of scolding their proprietors in vulgar editorial diatribes at or about election times. And we're getting it now, aren't we? That's right now, man. Occasionally they do descend into the streets, indulging in sanguinary vociferations upon the same general principle that impels a mangy cur to howl most dismally if struck with a brick. The conflict between the masters and the helots is over the present, and the masters, having conquered, are in possession of the booty in the field. Hark! The songs of victory, the flap of the battle pennons. Indeed, considering all the circumstances, the common people are lost souls. No matter what they do now, they must remain in hell. Their position is that of a worm trying to escape from its hole in a heated burning log. If it runs to the right, it runs into heat and smoke. If it runs to the left, it runs into blazes. A few minutes more, it's roasted alive. Even though America's servile multitudes appeal to the arbitrament of physical force, they cannot possibly win, possessing neither the strength, courage, brains, arms, money, or leaders. They must be blown into eternal fragments by their masters, highly trained artillerists and scientific destroyers. The citadel of power is now consolidated and prepared with the most improved armaments to repel an assault, no matter how well sustained. The nation is intersected in all directions with iron high roads and splendid waterways, whereupon the armies and navies may be moved from city to city with facility and dread effect. The war of secession, or rather the war of annihilation of self-government, demonstrated conclusively that a centralized authority rested on herd votes of the vulgar and fanatic is, in practice, military absolutism. There is no power in the land that can effectively hold it in check. The Tsar of Russia possesses less actual authority than our federal government. With a standing army in the hollow of his hands, it can do exactly as it pleases, i.e., if it can collect enough revenue to purchase statesmen and to pay the salaries of the Praetorian cohorts. And, of course, he's talking about Lincoln here, the dictator. Absolutely a dictator. And he instituted all kinds of dictatorial laws and so forth. Most Americans are only now beginning to perceive these things, but they were forsaken, and also foretold in part by clear-sighted individuals before the Constitution itself was formally enthroned. Today all the old Sphinx questions are up again for solution. No man of balanced sense can honestly believe that these problems are to be settled by ballot box stuffing or editorialism, letters to the editor. Settled they must be upon the good old rule of simple plan, and thereafter settled and resettled again and again, for there is no finality in social adjustments that there should be not be. Material strength is the basis of all human greatness, and material strength must settle the tyranny of the greatest number, probably with fire and steel. All other theories are chimeras, lies, delusions, make-believe, and of no account. Well, that's it for today, boys and girls. I hope you understand this. I hope you don't waste your life playing the game. I think most of us have wasted a lot of our life playing the game, but now you've got to come down to brass tacks. There's only one way to handle these bastards, and that's by brute force. And if you can't handle them by brute force, then you best just be quiet. And keep whining. But that's what we're up. All the people that talk about saving the white race, they're talking about playing the game, playing the Republican game, playing the voting game, playing the Constitution game. playing that I'll go over and get myself killed for you in the Middle East so you can make lots of money and live in fine houses and drive fine cars. I'll do that. Of course I will, because I love you. 14 words. 5 words. I have nothing to say.
Cheer up, man. You know what they say? Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble. Give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the bright side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your life chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
Come on, try and cheer up.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on.
We'll come from nothing, you know what I say?
Oh,
cheer up, you old bugger. Come on, give us a quiz. There you are. See? The end of the film. Incidentally, this record's available in the foyer.
Always look on the right.
Someone's got to live as well, you know. Who do you think pays for this rubbish?
Always look on the money back, you know.
I told him. I said to him. Bernie, I said, they'll never make that money back.
The great sport today is watching the white race give everything they've got over to the dusky hordes, the Untermenschen, and praise the Lord for doing it.